let's get started. So the topic for tonight,
we're on the recorder,
is the life of Theodore Herzl up until the first Zionist Congress. Plenty of good seats still available. So in the previous lectures, we discussed the forerunners of Zionism, and we discussed Chibat Sion and cultural Zionism. But now we're up to the real heart of political Zionism, that of Theodore Herzl. He's born in Budapest in 1860 to an assimilated Jewish family. And it's important to understand what Budapest was like in the 1860s for the Jews. It was a time when, from a political perspective, Jews are doing quite well. The full emancipation of the Jews of the Habsburg Empire occurs around that time. In 1867, you have the creation of the Hungarian Kingdom, which is an adjunct to Austria, so it's now Austria-Hungary, with the Habsburg monarch being the king of Hungary, and he's beloved in the eyes of the Jews, because now they're fully free. But culturally, most Jews are not Magyar, at least not yet. They're not Hungarian. They're German. As a general rule, when Jews abandon their old world identity, culturally speaking, linguistically speaking, they do so not to go down a rank, but to go up a rank, to the highest rank. And what's the highest? Germany. German language, German culture. So although he's living in Budapest, he speaks German as his first language, and Hungarian only sparingly, and tries to erase any Hungarian connections later on. His father, Jacob Herzl, mother Jeanette Herzl, the father is a well-to-do businessman who made a lot of money when the economy was good and lost a lot of money when the economy was bad, but made more than he lost, so they were still very comfortable, which was important because throughout Herzl's career he's going to need to rely upon that family wealth to fund his activities. Before there are wealthy patrons or a mass subscription of people giving a shekel to the Zionist cause, it's a one-man operation. A one-man operation only works if you have financial reserves, which he did, courtesy of his family's wealth. The family is not religious in the least. And Herzl, although he goes to the synagogue and has a circumcision in his earliest childhood, is not a synagogue goer later in his childhood and doesn't even have a bar mitzvah. At the age of 13, he has a confirmation.
Is it true that he did not have his son circumcised?
That is true, and we'll discuss what happens to the children soon enough. But you're right, he didn't circumcise his son. The family is not religious, but bear in mind that they're only really one generation removed from old world Judaism, because Herzl's grandfather, Simon Herzl, lived in Semlin, which was not far from Belgrade, in the southern part of the empire. And Simon Herzl was a gabbai, a shamus, to Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. And if you recall from a month ago, we said Yehuda Alkalai was one of the forerunners of Zionism, one of the two big rabbis, Kalischer and Alkalai, who, well before their time, were advocating settlement on the land in Eretz Yisrael. So there's a big machloikis among the historians as to what extent the image of his saintly grandfather, who believed in Zion, had an impact on young Theodore. In his writings, in his private diary, he never mentions that his grandfather was a Judaic influence on him, certainly not a Zionistic influence on him. So shall we say that Herzl was suppressing it, and even in his own private diaries he didn't want to admit it, or that there really was no influence, or that there was, but it was so subconscious that he didn't even think of it? You could pick A, B, or C, whatever you like. But he certainly doesn't write about it and never openly admits it. Well, it was the style of the time for the Jews of Budapest to try to blend in culturally and to escape the consequences of their Jewish baggage, and in the process to develop some element of self-hatred, sort of a Yiddish anti-Semit. But let's distinguish between Jewish anti-Semitism and Gentile anti-Semitism. Jewish anti-Semitism is just a psychological disorder. Gentile anti-Semitism leads to murder. But still, for the up-and-coming and sort of snooty elite of the Central European cities, where the Jews are escaping their old-world identity, it's very easy to look down upon the Jews as a class or as a race as having bad habits and bad physiognomy and bad taste. And even though you're a Jew yourself, you subscribe to all the worst stereotypes that the anti-Semites say about the Jews. Herzl, to an extent, was guilty of that in his earlier years. And in 1878, well, before 1878, as a youngster, he was interested in science and in engineering. And he was amazed by the Suez Canal project. And he wanted to go into science as a career. But he wasn't good at it. So in his teenage years, he shifted gears towards the Belles Lettres and to be a writer, to be a playwright. In 1878, shortly before he graduates high school, his sister Pauline dies of typhus suddenly and unexpectedly. And this was a devastating blow. There were only two children in the family, and he loved his sister very much. He would end up naming his daughter after her, Pauline. And so now he's an only child. His parents are distraught, mother totally devastated. They have to move. Where are they going to go? Vienna. So in 1878, they pick up and move to Vienna. As a upper middle class family with cash to spend. They're not the only ones moving to Vienna. The Jewish population of Vienna is growing dramatically. Whereas in the 1820s, there were maybe 6,000 Jews there. By 1878, there are 60,000 Jews there. Now, a tenfold increase is a substantial increase. That's well more than... So the answer, well, Freud lived about a block away from Herzl. Several very famous people who went on to have illustrious careers in a wide range of fields were all born around 1860 and all lived in Vienna and all knew each other from the street.
None of them went to shul.
No. So the Hasidim, they move in later. That's a early 20th century phenomenon. We're now talking about people moving to Vienna from other parts of the Habsburg Empire, notably from Galicia, where eventually Hasidim would come from, but also from Hungary. So you have the old Viennese Jews, like the proper Viennese Jews, who were around from the time immemorial, and the newcomers. But the newcomers were, for the most part, not religious. And it was not a pious culture in Vienna Jewry, not at all. Okay, so Herzl goes to the University of Vienna, where he's studying, but his heart really isn't in his studies. His heart is in his writing. He thinks he's going to be a famous writer one day, a playwright. And in Vienna, it's the capital of culture for all of Europe, where the theater is everything. They say if politics was where people focused on in Paris, then culture, the theater, was the focus in Vienna. And he thought one day in the chief theater in Vienna, his plays were going to be performed. But he didn't achieve much success at first. His writing was mediocre. His friend, Arthur Schnitzler, had much greater success than he did. So he tries his hand at various types of writing and submits his pieces of work to all sorts of publications, doesn't achieve much success. He doesn't have many friends. Why? Because he's an arrogant jerk. He had trouble sustaining friendships because he was overbearing. Nobody wanted to be around him, and he didn't want to be around them, to be honest. He also had trouble on the romantic front. He didn't get married until 29, and all throughout his 20s, he had difficulty cultivating an amorous relationship with a woman. He would fall in love with young girls. Not that he was a pedophile, God forbid, I'm not saying that, but in his writings he would say, I fell in love with this 9-year-old girl, a 13-year-old girl. But it was like a fleeting thing. It's hard to explain. It's not the pedophilia of today. It's a different genre. He got sick. He got sick and developed ailments, eventually probably caused his heart disease, from getting venereal disease from a prostitute when he was 20. But all this is the schmutz about his earlier life. That
he died at
44 of bad heart disease. So he doesn't have many attachments that's holding him down. Doesn't have a career yet. Doesn't have a family yet. He has these ideas of glory as a writer, but is getting nowhere. He passes the exams to be a lawyer in 1883 at the age of 23, and for a time he thinks he might actually have a stable career in the law. The problem is that the civil service wasn't really open to Jews. So the Jews flooded the so-called free professions, the free professions primarily being medicine and the law, but the law not as a government official, but rather as an advocate, as a barrister, in the courtroom. But he wasn't interested in pushing papers, so this was not going to last. He was going to have to run away from his formal profession and fall back upon the pen, where he thought he would achieve great glory. Whenever he had a problem and was depressed and moody and was not achieving the success that he thought that he deserved, his parents would pay for a long extended vacation. And that's where I said how the family wealth plays an important role. He would travel to France, to Belgium, all over Europe. And this was able to distract him from his lack of success.
Was the mental illness in his family because of kids later on being suicide and stuff like
that? We're going to get to that right now. So in 1889, he finally gets married to Julie Neuschauer, who, if he came from a somewhat wealthy family, she came from an uber-wealthy family. Her father was a railroad baron of some kind. And the dowry was 75,000 francs that produced enough interest income to keep them afloat. Herzl had modest tastes, but Julie had very expensive tastes. So unfortunately, despite the dowry and the income from the dowry, they were in financial difficulty because of her frivolous spending. Their first child was Pauline, named after Herzl's sister, was born in 1890. The second child was Hans, born in 1891. And as was mentioned before, Hans was not circumcised. Herzl was a Goyish Jew and wasn't ashamed of it. In fact, I'll just quote a story that already when he had turned the page in his life and become a Zionist agitator and was trying to secure the cooperation of the chief rabbi of Vienna, Dr. Moritz Gudemann, for this purpose, which he ultimately failed. Gudemann eventually would be a non-Zionist. Gudemann arrived at Herzl's apartment on December 24th, 1895, to find that Herzl was lighting the Christmas tree. And Gudemann said to him, it's pasnish for the leader of Jewish nationalism to be lighting a Christmas tree, to which Herzl angrily responded, it's none of your damn business. Call it a Hanukkah bush if you want. Just leave me alone.
Yeah.
Okay, so they have two children, but then they separate because it's a bad marriage, it's a bad shidduch. She was crazy. She was a psychotic from her infancy, and he didn't know that before they got married. They asked Gudemann to try to mediate a divorce, and he said, I'm in the business of solemnizing marriages, not mediating divorces. So Herzl has a solution to his family life problem, and that is to run away. But not to run away on a long vacation, but rather to run away on business. And that is to become a correspondent in France, in Paris, for the new Free Press, the Neue Freie Press, which was the leading liberal newspaper in Vienna. It was owned by two assimilated Jews. I think one of them might have even been baptized, Bacher and Benedict. And all the upper middle class types read it, which means all the Jews read it. It was a very illustrious paper. It had a small actual circulation of maybe 35,000, 40,000 readers every day, but the people in high places all read that newspaper. And to be a correspondent in those years was a big gadilla. It was a major thing to be the Paris correspondent for the most important newspaper in Europe. It gave Herzl cachet and entree into the halls of power, which he would later use to his advantage when he becomes a Zionist. Okay, well, what does he see in France of the early 1890s? What is happening in France in the early 1890s?
Dreyfus.
So before Dreyfus, there's political turmoil and corruption at the highest levels. And the idea of Republican France is... We'll get to that. It's not just yet. In 1891, 2, and 3, the major issues are political turmoil and the thought that maybe the monarchy might have to be restored, that the republic can't survive because everybody's crooked and everyone's taking bribes, including cabinet officials and prime ministers. So there's a lot of tumult in Paris, and Herzl gets to see it firsthand, and he learns the dirty tricks of politics. So he's schooled in the methods of political activity while being a journalist in you know in a non-Jewish environment, which was very good for him, for his education. Okay. Eventually, his family moves to Paris, and he reconciles with his wife, and they have a third kid named Trudy. So at this point, I'll stop and just mention what happens to the various children. It's a very sad situation. Because Julie was psychotic, so the kids also suffered from a lot of psychological issues. Pauline, the oldest, she died of an overdose, basically a suicide, in 1930 at the age of 40. Her funeral was a few days later, at which Hans shot himself. So they two of them committed suicide, basically back to back in 1930. Trudy was
the fact that Herzl was long gone. Back.
Herzl was long gone. He died. He died before his parents did. He died in 1904 at the age of 44. So Trudy was the one who was the normal one, and she got married and had to a guy named Newman, and had a child, Stephen Theodore Newman. In the mid-1930s, when he was a teenager, the Zionists in England decided to do a favor for the grandchild of Herzl and whisk him out of Austria just before the Nazi takeover. So he grew up in his later teenage years in England and then was drafted into the army in World War II and served admirably for England. But then after the war was over, he kind of couldn't make a go of it in England. Chaim Weizmann tried to get him a patronage job. He moved to America and was living in Washington, but really life was miserable for him, and he found out that his mother died in Theresienstadt, so Herzl's daughter died in Theresienstadt, and the whole family was wiped out, extended family, so he was morose, and he committed suicide. Oh. He jumped off the Massachusetts Avenue Bridge in Washington, D.C. In 1946. So Herzl had three kids, and two committed suicide, one died in the Holocaust, and one grandchild committed suicide. What happened to Stephen Newman, who anglicized his name to Stephen Norman, was that his remains, which were buried in a Jewish cemetery near Washington, were transferred to Israel, to Mount Herzl, in 2007. Why did it take so long to move Herzl's grandchild to near Herzl's grave? As they say, someone said, it was Zionist sclerosis, or it was apathy. They couldn't get their act together to move his body. I mean, after all, they didn't move Jabotinsky for 24 years. So sometimes disinterring somebody and moving them, that was a separate matter. I know, Ben-Gurion prevented it. But the point is, it didn't happen for a long time. Yeah.
They first moved Herzl in 1949. I was there.
Yeah.
I watched it when they brought him on the truck.
Yeah.
When they interred him.
Right. Well, his instructions were that he didn't want to be disinterred until a Jewish government were able to move him. So as soon as the war was over, it happened in 49. Okay. Well, Herzl functions in this capacity for a few years in Paris as a reporter. And the legend is that the Dreyfus trial was a major influence on his life and turned him from being apathetic towards Jewish affairs towards being a staunch Zionist. Herzl, in his lifetime already, allowed that legend and that myth to grow. But it really isn't true. In fact, Herzl, his whole life, was aware of his Jewish identity and the fact that he was suffering disabilities because of that identity, meaning he couldn't enter to the civil service in Austria on account of it. While he was in college, in university, he joined a fraternity, which was a German nationalist fraternity. Now, bear in mind, Herzl was a German nationalist before he was a Jewish nationalist. And many Jews in that environment found themselves as staunch German nationalists, because they believed that the German component of Austria should be the dominant component and it should win out over all the other ethnic minorities. Jews were not rallying to the cause of the Czechs or the Slovaks or the Serbs or the Croats. They were in favor of the German element of Austria-Hungary. And so In the university, he palled around with these kind of people, but the problem is those are the very same Gentiles who are likely to turn anti-Semitic. And he had to resign from his fraternity, the Albia fraternity, after a dueling episode, because they just hated Jews. Now, there were several occasions when he was confronted with the possibility of a real duel, not with swords, where you just get scratched in the face, but with guns. And that was actually quite popular in 1880s and 1890s Vienna. But he somehow was able to avoid this and didn't die a sort of a sad death in his 20s in the 1880s. So he already knows that anti-Semitism is a problem. He's not oblivious to it. And in the 1890s, early 1890s in France, you have plenty of episodes of duels where a Jew is made fun of for being a Jew, and then they go to shoot it out, and the Jew dies. Ongoing problem. The Dreyfus incident was basically the straw that broke the camel's back. It was the last thing, not the first thing, that he was encountering in terms of Jew hatred. Already before the Dreyfus affair, he's writing a novel called The New Ghetto. The New Ghetto is about a sort of an upper middle class Western Jew, basically himself, who can't make a go of it, can't fully enter Western society because it's impossible even for an assimilated Jew to fully integrate into the Gentile society because they're not wanted. There's this gap that separates the Jew from the other that can never be overcome. At that point, Herzl doesn't have a solution to the problem. He just recognizes there is a problem. It will take a few more years for him to develop the solution, which is Jewish statehood. Okay, so...
Was he knowledgeable of the writings that he learned in the other classes?
No, he was a complete ignorant... Amoritz knew nothing. He, in fact, after he writes Der Judenstaat in 1895, 1896, will say, upon being told of Auto Emancipation, written by Leo Pinsker in 1882, he then reads it and says, you know, it's a good thing I didn't read this before, because if I had read it before, I wouldn't have written my book, because he said everything I was going to say. So he knew nothing. And as for Moses Hess, Roman Jerusalem, I mentioned about 2 months ago that he didn't even read it until 1898, and he didn't finish it. He put it down because he was bored. And he finished it 3 years later in 1901, which goes to show that Hess's work wasn't all that important. I like it, but Herzl didn't like it. So Herzl knew nothing. He never met Eastern European Jewry. So he knew that they were suffering under the yoke of the Tsar, but he really had flimsy knowledge of the whole thing. So 1893, he writes The New Ghetto. 1894, Dreyfus Affair. When it comes to Dreyfus's guilt or innocence, something really important must be said. Most French Jews at first thought that Dreyfus was guilty. And...
Can you tell us who Dreyfus was?
Okay, so Alfred Dreyfus was on the general staff of the French army, and he was accused of treason, of supplying state secrets to Germany, which at a time when France and Germany had just fought the Franco-Prussian War and would fight again in World War I and again in World War II, to be a balavera of treason at that time, in that regard, was a real problem. Now, it was all a hoax.
He was Alsatian,
which is an important component. So people would say that his geographic background made him more inclined to favor Germany over France, which is true about, Mr. Klapholz can tell us that the majority of French Jews were not really French Jews, but they were from Alsace-Lorraine, which was real Ashkenaz, true Ashkenaz Jewry in the traditional sense of Ashkenaz, and gravitated towards Paris and other parts of France later in time. So it was easy to accuse them of having Germanophile sentiment. Okay, but it wasn't true in this case. It was all a fraud. It was an anti-Semitic canard. But the Jews believed it. So they say that for every 100 French Jews, when the Dreyfus affair first broke out, that for every two, of 100 French Jews, for every two that thought that Dreyfus was innocent, there were 98 who would volunteer to be a prison guard in Devil's Island, where he was interred. I don't know if that's an exaggeration or not, but the point is French Jews were very patriotic. So patriotic that when you accuse one of them of wrongdoing, they figure, you know what? He did it. And we're going to, with everyone else, with all the goyim, say, condemn the man.
But there was strong anti-Semitism.
Granted, that's true. So when did Herzl turn around? About 2 weeks after the story broke, Herzl realized this can't be true. This guy's incapable of treason. He's too much of a dullard. It was actually a shtach of Dreyfus that Herzl thought lowly of him as a dullard, an adult, that he was incapable of the sophistication of treason. So it was just an anti-Semitic conspiracy. That's what Herzl concluded. Herzl was physically present when they did the degradation ceremony and broke the guy's sword and stripped him of his badges and put him out in shackles and take him to prison. Herzl was there as a member of the media.
He wrote it up.
And this did influence him tremendously to recognize that if 100 years after the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen in Paris, this can happen to an innocent man, then the Jews of Europe have no future. And an evacuationist policy is the correct policy. Up until that time, he wondered, you know, what is the solution? There is a problem, but I don't think of a solution. Now, you got to evacuate. But in evacuating, well, what do? Anywhere you go, you could recreate the same problem. Now, who thought that? Pinsker thought the same thing. If we all go to another location in the diaspora that currently is fine, we'll just bring our problems to that new location. So therefore, it has to be a Jewish state. But where is that Jewish state going to be? I don't know. Herzl, at first, doesn't favor Eretz Yisrael. Why not?
There's nothing there.
No, so actually, none of the above. None of the above. His initial opposition to Eretz Yisrael was that it's too close to Russia, and that the problem is Tsarist oppression of the Jews. That Herzl acknowledged that although Western Jews feel uncomfortable in the Western diaspora, in France, Germany, etc., they're not being really persecuted terribly, and plenty of them will want to stay there. The real problem is for the Jews of the East, who have it miserable and are desperate to get out. But Russia is too close to the Middle East, too close to Eretz Yisrael, and as the Ottoman Empire is teetering on the brink of failure, Russia's going to swoop down below, like you know Putin does today in Syria, and they'll have a sphere of influence in the Middle East, and so it won't be good to try to build a Jewish state there, it's too close. The other factor was the climate, that the Jews are accustomed to a northern, colder climate, not a tropical or Middle Eastern climate, and so they're not going to be ready for that kind of lifestyle. Yet somehow the Hasidim in Israel today do fine with Bekishes. I don't know. Yeah, it amazes me. So this is what he's thinking, 1894 going into 1895. So he has ideas that he wants to write down on paper and present to a rich guy. Which rich guy? The answer is Baron Maurice de Hirsch. So Baron Maurice de Hirsch was the richest man probably in the world, and certainly the richest Jew in the world, richer than any one of the Rothschilds. I mean, the Rothschilds collectively probably had more money than Hirsch, but each one of them had only a sector of the family wealth. Hirsch had between 500 to 700 million French francs. A tremendous amount of money.
What did he make of it?
Partly railroads and partly, I think, alcohol. But mostly railroads. And he lived part of the time in Paris and had dachas all over Eastern and Central Europe. So Hirsch was a philanthropist. And he gave about 180 million francs of his tremendous wealth in the cause of Jewish philanthropy. But what he wanted to do was make the Jews productive tillers of the soil somewhere outside of Europe in order to prove that they could be physically productive and then maybe for those who would stay in Europe also till the soil there as well. Where did he send them? So Argentina, South America. About 6,000 people were sent to South America. That's a lot of money to spend on 6,000 people. And Herzl would accuse him of wasting a lot of his funds because this is not a good bang for your buck. There's not a lot of return on investment. What Maurice de Hirsch wanted was for Jews to stop striving for the top. That the problem is anti-Semitism is in part the result of economic competition, that when Jews are given the opportunity to enter into the university and go into the free professions, they do so, but in too large of a number, and they're disproportionately represented, and it exacerbates anti-Semitism because now you can't be a Goyish lawyer or a doctor because there are too many Jewish lawyers and doctors. So what do you need to do? Make the Jews into farmers. And then nobody will complain. So Hirsch gave a lot of money, a lot of money. The Jewish Colonialization Association, the JCA. What Herzl wants Hirsch to do is now to say, instead of sending a few people here, a few people there, let's solve the Jewish problem wholesale by creating a Jewish state, whether in South America or in Eretz Yisrael, because now he's warming up to the idea of Eretz Yisrael. But Maurice de Hirsch, like all the other big heavy hitters, including all the philanthropists, is not interested in Jewish statehood and fears that the project of striving for Jewish statehood will just make anti-Semitism worse, because all the canards that were leveled against the Jews will now assume to be true, that they're not really loyal, that they have their heart in another place, that they're looking to undermine society. All the criticisms could be leveled with even greater intensity and ferocity if Zionism were to take off. That was Hirsch's perspective. Now, Herzl was lucky to get a meeting with him, because with Albert Rothschild of Vienna, he never even got a meeting. So, but Herzl was concerned, maybe this meeting is going to go very, very poorly, and it will be cut short, because he'll think I'm just a schnorrer, looking for a handout, or that I'm looking for a job in one of his businesses. Because after all, these guys got hit with schnorrers all the time, and what makes Herzl any different? Yes, he's an illustrious correspondent in a newspaper, but still, maybe he just wants a handout. So Herzl was neurotic about this. He wanted to look presentable, but not too presentable. So he bought a pair of white gloves in the Macy's or whatever it was there before the meeting. Fancy, fancy gloves, but he crumpled them up. Why? Because you want to look good, but not too good. Because if it looks like I just bought this with a tag still on, he's going to know I'm trying to impress him too much. Obsessing of every little detail. He writes a prepared speech of 13 handwritten pages that he wants to read to Hirsch, word for word, line by line. He never gets to more than half of it before the meeting gets cut short. But, interestingly, 5 minutes into the meeting, Hirsch gets a phone call. A phone call? Who has telephones then? Well, it's 1896, 1895, and the rich have telephones, okay? The Amcha doesn't have telephones, but the rich have telephones. So, why was there a telephone call? Well, like when a boy and a girl go out on a date to Starbucks, and what happens a half hour into the date? Somebody gets a phone call. Why? It's prearranged in case the date is going bad. Someone's in the hospital. I got to run. Sorry, date's over. So Hirsch got a phone call 5 minutes into the meeting, and Herzl's like, oh, man, this is finished. He's going to say he's busy. He can't see me anymore. No. Instead, Hirsch said, I'm busy now, and hung up. That was the signal that he was interested, that the meeting wasn't going to be cut short. It was going to last a full hour or two. Okay, but when the meeting is over, it was a failure. Hirsch doesn't accept Herzl's proposal that he should take on leadership in a Zionist movement or a Jewish nationalist movement, and they go their separate ways. Later, a week later, Herzl writes a nasty letter to Hirsch saying, you could have been our champion and you dropped the ball. But he was regretful of the nasty letter afterwards, because he realized it's a mistake to annoy wealthy people. You never know when they could turn around and shuts the door any cooperation. As it turned out, Hirsch dies a year later, just before the first Zionist Congress, and so his money never went for Zionism. Had he been generous, then the 50 years of Zionist activity from 1897 to 1947, which was always marred by a lack of funds, never a lack of political will, but a lack of money, maybe that never would have happened. And the Pushka with the JNF, it would have been instead rich man Hirsch's estate. Didn't work out that way. Okay.
Rothschild wouldn't have played such a key role if Hirsch stepped up to the plate.
Well, Rothschild ultimately doesn't play the role that Herzl wants him to play. Rothschild, the Paris Rothschild, as I'm going to say in a second, plays the role of philanthropist, but only that of philanthropist, not of political activist. So let's see the next point. Herzl wants a meeting with the Rothschild family, and he writes a speech for the Rothschilds, a 68-page handwritten manifesto. He likes to write a lot, and he likes to read his writing to rich people, word for word. But Albert Rothschild doesn't want to meet him. Albert is the Vienna branch of the family.
Not known for his philanthropy. Edmund was the Paris branch, is known for his philanthropy, the Hanadiv HaYadua. So who does Herzl turn to try to get the meeting with Albert Rothschild? Well, the chief rabbi of Vienna, Moritz Gudermann. And Gudermann, who, as I mentioned a number of weeks ago, was in favor of retaining the Zionide passages in the Siddur. So as a liturgical matter, he was anti-reform and in favor of Tzion, but as a practical matter, he would drop the ball. He led on Herzl to think that he would be a supporter, but in the end, failed him, and in fact wrote a manifesto against the against Jewish statehood. So he refuses to serve as a go-between to get to Albert Rothschild. It is not a success. Eventually, Herzl will get a meeting after several rejections with Edmund Rothschild in Paris. Now, Edmund Rothschild was the Nadiv HaYadua, the great benefactor. What did he do? He basically paid for and propped up all the settlements in Eretz Yisrael from the first Aliyah. The first Aliyah, I mean, who went in the early 1880s? People who had nothing, for the most part, and who couldn't make a go of it financially without outside assistance. They would have all collapsed and failed if not for his influx of cash. But he didn't do it because he believed in nationalism or that this was going to result in the full flowering of Jewish civilization. He did it just as charity. But even with charity, he wanted it to be financially viable. So what did he do? He sent his administrators to run these yeshuvim along his lines to make them productive. And
did he establish the winery?
So they established the winery so that eventually these settlements would be financially viable. Arayomazeh, correct. Arayomazeh, you have these wineries. Okay, so he met with this Rothschild, and the meeting doesn't go well. Herzl doesn't believe in infiltration of Eretz Yisrael by small groups of Jews. He wants public recognition of Zionism and of the return of the Jews to the land and eventual statehood. And he believes that the handful of settlements that currently exist are actually detrimental because you're wasting all your resources on just a few thousand people. I mean, there were 3,000-4,000 people at most in these yeshuvim that were being supported by Edmund Rothschild. So that meeting didn't go well. Herzl had a habit of not doing well with the rich guys. But he threatened them. How can he threaten them? Who is he to threaten them? The answer is, he threatened them that if I don't get your cooperation, and if Zionism does not get off the ground as an aristocratic movement, then it will become a popular movement. Against your wishes, you rich guys. That the plutocrats will be out, and instead, hundreds of thousands of people will, at the grassroots level, support my endeavors, and will collectively have enough political force to make this possible. Was Herzl right or was he wrong? Well, he was right, ultimately, because really Zionism was about the individual paying the shekel, that tens and hundreds of thousands of people participating in the movement, and it developing its own core of political activists and diplomatic activists. And the wealthy, yes, they were important in supporting various projects, but really it was a mass movement, not a movement of the elites only. Okay. So, Herzl needs help with his project. But he first has to get the word out. He has to publish his ideas. So the speech to the Rothschilds is converted into a booklet. It runs less than 100 pages. Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, the solution to the Jewish problem. Who publishes it? Well, Jewish publishing houses, and there were a lot of them because publishing was a Jewish business, refused to take the book. They don't want to cause a problem. They don't want to foment anti-Semitism. Because remember, Zionism equals anti-Semitism. That's what everybody thought. So it took a non-Jewish publisher of no great fame, one of the back alleys of Vienna, to take the manifest and print 500 copies. And in February of 1896, Herzl gets the shipment to his apartment of the 500 copies, and he's going to distribute them. Well, before he distributes it, he has to deal with his bosses, the editors at the New Free Press. Benedict and Bacher. They had made him the literary editor of the paper in 1895 when he left Paris and came back to Vienna. And they don't like Zionism one bit. They are stodgy, assimilated Jews who don't want to rock the boat and who fear what Zionism could bring for establishment Jews like them. So they tell Herzl, listen, we're not going to publish this in our paper. He wanted them at first to have to publish a supplement to the newspaper in which he would include the Jewish state, not as a book, but as a newspaper supplement. They said, absolutely not. And then he said, well, will you at least write a review of my book after it comes out? And they gave intimation that maybe they would, and then they refused to do that. And then they told him, we are not going to cover your activities at all. There will be no reference to Zionism in this newspaper. And it held true throughout his lifetime, even after the Zionist movement had congresses and was a real factor in international affairs. I mean, a minor one, but it was newsworthy, and yet the paper refused to cover it. And he got into big fights with them over this issue. Now, the paper had also ignored something else. They ignored socialism. As socialism was on the rise in Western Europe and in Central Europe, they didn't want to cover that either. Because, so I said, hear no evil, see no evil. We want liberalism and only liberalism. Okay. So, Herzl writes his book. It's disseminated. And there's a reaction. The reaction in the West is not very favorable. The reaction in the East is extremely favorable, which is not surprising. After all, the people in the East need a hero. Herzl is the Messiah, is the new Moses, and he's a doctor noch. So, Dr. Herzl. So, of course, the Jewish Messiah is going to be a doctor. But in the West, it was not well received. Herzl did have some allies in Western Europe. In England, he had them more so than in Germany and Austria. Now, there's a reason why. In Germany and Austria, the emancipation was relatively recent. And people were afraid that if you espouse Jewish nationalism, it could result in the rollback of Jewish rights. I mean, the rollback of Jewish rights would happen by 1933-35. Jewish emancipation in Central Europe really only lasted about 65 years before the Nazi period. But people were nervous about this prospect. In England, however, the Jews had basically been free since their arrival in the 1650s. I mean, yes, there were certain legal disabilities, and a Jew couldn't enter Parliament until 1858, but basically, since the 1700s, Jews were free in England, and it was a wonderful place to be a Jew. Not for Judaism. Judaism kind of was weak, but politically, a Jew was free. So the Jews were less worried about supporting Jewish nationalism. Also, what kind of Jews live in England in the 1890s? So, yes, there's the old branch of the British Jewry that's been around since the days of Oliver Cromwell, but most of them were recent expatriates from Russia, the Ostjuden. And the Ostjuden are all lovers of Zionism, like, except for the Bundist types, but basically Eastern Jews like Zionism. So the Gentiles have Philo-Semitic British Protestant pro-Zionist types. The Eastern Jews like it, and even some of the Western Jews in England like Zionism. For example, Samuel Montague, who was an Orthodox Jew, whose daughter would become the leader of the Reform movement there, and Goldsmith. Now, who was Goldsmith? So, Sir Albert Goldsmith was a British Army officer who was born to assimilated parents, and he was baptized as a child, recovered his Judaism later in life, and had an illustrious military career, and raised his daughters as Orthodox Jews and taught them Hebrew in the home, and was a proud British patriot. But when he heard Herzl, he says, I'm your man. And he said to Herzl a very famous sentence. He said, I am Daniel Deronda. Who is Daniel Deronda? So George Eliot was the author of Daniel Deronda, 20 years earlier, about a Jew who's born a Christian, recovers their Judaism, has a career as a Jewish, as a British patriot and a Jewish patriot, and discovers a Jewish statehood, a Jewish nationalism. So he says, this is a fictional account, but yet I am that person in the flesh. That's really me. It's my life. And I am your man here in England.
Obviously, this Durando was a known factor in those days there.
Well, he's not a real person.
No, I'm saying...
Goldsmith...
The image.
The image was known, yes.
But George Eliot himself...
Herself, she was a woman. Despite the name George, she was a girl.
But anti-Semitic?
No. Okay, so... Herzl has a few friends in England. Another one is Israel Zangwill. Who's Israel Zangwill?
A big writer.
He's a big writer. He's famous for translating the Piyutim in the Machzor. So,
I think the conservative movement kind of adopted.
They adopted his writings. Yeah. Well, Herzl goes to London in 1895, and he meets with a degree of success. So he knows that he has some friends in Western Europe. He knows he has some friends, but not too many in Central Europe. And after the publication of the Jewish state, he has a lot of friends in Eastern Europe. And in fact, in Sofia, Bulgaria, he's proclaimed the Mashiach.
Bulgaria.
He's proclaimed the Mashiach. Okay, but he needs to have some political success. He's got to do something. It's not enough to just write a book. But where is he going to get access to important people? He thinks the solution is in the halls of power of Europe, not in Eretz Yisrael. So he gets lucky. He develops two allies in his cause. One of them is William Hechler. Who is William Hechler? He's the Anglican minister or chaplain in the British Embassy in Vienna. So not exactly a very important person, but someone with connections. And this guy is a millennial type. He believes that the Jewish restoration is going to happen in the year 1897 or 1898, based upon his calculations of the books of the Bible, the book of Ezra Nehemiah and the book of Daniel. He did the math, and there's going to be a return to Zion in 1897 or 1898. Now, Herzl doesn't even believe in God. So some Meshuggah Anglican priest is coming to him saying, you're going to have a Jewish state in the next 2 years. All right, he's crazy, but let me see what he can do for me. Now, as it turned out, this priest was good friends and had been the tutor of the children of the Grand Duke of Baden. So the Grand Duke of Baden is a friend of Hechler. The Grand Duke of Baden is the uncle of Kaiser Wilhelm II, the Kaiser of Germany. So he gets Herzl a meeting with the Grand Duke of Baden, and the Grand Duke is all in favor. Yeah, the Jews are going to leave Germany? Wonderful. Okay? So, but not the Jews of Baden, because they're protected under his patronage. So, but all the other Jews, oh, wonderful, they'll go to the Jewish state. So he's all in favor. So Herzl says, can you talk to the Kaiser about this and try to make it happen? And he says, I'll see what I can do. I'll talk to the Kaiser. So getting a meeting with the Kaiser becomes Herzl's chief diplomatic goal between 1896 and 1898. He ultimately will meet the Kaiser a few times in Constantinople and in Eretz Yisrael. There's a famous picture of him waving to the Kaiser who's riding on a horse right outside of Petach Tikva. Okay. Well, that's one angle. But the other angle is you got to do something in Constantinople because the Turks are in control of Eretz Yisrael. So some entree must be found for negotiations with the Sultan over the fate of the territory. Now, Herzl's idea is that the Jews will come up with a lot of money. They'll pay off the Turkish debt to Britain and France, because the Ottoman Empire was horribly in debt and was basically bankrupt and enslaved financially to the Western European powers. So we'll pay that off, and you'll give us a state in Palestine, or if not a real state, at least a vassal state in Palestine. Was it a ridiculous idea? No, it wasn't, because in fact, the British had actually bought Cyprus from the Turks in 1878, 18 years earlier, for £1 million or something like that, for some nominal sum. The sale of territory for a price was not unheard of in 19th century life. It was actually a common feature. So why can't it happen that the Jews buy their way back into their ancient homeland?
Well, very simple. That same homeland was also sacred to the Muslims.
Okay, so interestingly, most of the Turkish officials didn't have a problem with the Eretz Yisrael or Palestine as such. It was the holy places in Jerusalem that were a sore point, and Herzl had a solution for that, which is not all that different from the 1947 partition plan, namely the internationalization of the holy places, that even though there's going to be a Jewish state or a Jewish sovereign entity under Turkish auspices, that Jerusalem and its holy places will always have extraterritoriality. It's a nice little solution to the problem. Moshe Dayan could have gone for that one. Well, now, Herzl needs to get to the Sultan somehow. Well, he finds a go-between. Count Philip Michael Nevlinsky. Now, Count Nevlinsky was probably a double agent or a triple agent or a quadruple agent. He was in the pay of a lot of European powers, was a spy, and people spied on him. But he was in late 19th century Europe, that was not unheard of and was not even seen as disreputable. It was, you were an independent operator. You were involved in diplomacy for a living, but not for any state to which you owe an allegiance, a patriotic allegiance, but rather you just work and you do your business, and your business involves multiple states. So who was he? He was a Polish noble. He was a Polish noble whose family had participated in the 1863 Polish rebellion against the Tsar. Now what happened to the Poles who participated in that rebellion? Well, some got killed, and even the ones who didn't get killed, they lost their estates. So you were a noble, but just with a title. You had nothing to back it up, so you needed to work for a living. And what did he do for a living? He was a player in the diplomatic scene, putting money in his pocket from different sources. But he had close contact with the Sultan, Abdul Hamid II, and was able to bring Herzl along to Constantinople for a week-long visit in June of 1896 to see if they could make a deal with the Sultan. Well, Herzl never gets to meet the Sultan, at least not yet. He will meet him later on, a few years later. But he meets with other officials, the Grand Vizier and other foreign ministry officials, has to pay a lot of bribes. Where is he getting the money for all this? The answer is his own pocket. It cost him about $2,000 that trip. It's a lot of money by 1896 standards. So he's bribing with bakshish all these different officials to try to get some kind of a deal, but the Sultan won't hear of it. Some of his officials are telling Herzl, we could never sell territory because the territory doesn't belong to the government but belongs to the people of the empire, and it's not the Sultan's to sell, which is rubbish, but that's the story they were telling. Alternatively, we're interested, but we can't get rid of the holy place, we can't give you the holy places, so you'll have to settle on some other territory within the realm. To which Herzl responds, well, our people want Palestine, our people want their ancient homeland. He stays a week and is ready to go home when he recognizes he's not going to go meeting with the Sultan. But he needs something, some token of success. And just before he leaves, he's given a sword with the cross of the order of so-and-so. So he becomes like a low-level knight of some kind under the Ottoman regime. A modest token of the Sultan's interest in his deal. So Herzl goes home. It's now the latter half of 1896. Herzl never really bothered to think about something. He's really a charlatan because he has nothing to support whatever deal he's offering to any political official, whether in Ottoman Empire or even among the European powers. He's projecting Jewish power that doesn't really exist. I mean, he spoke to the rich Jews. They didn't give him their backing. He tells them, well, I'll make it into a mass movement. And maybe he'll be successful at that, but it's not a mass movement yet. And he's trying to cut deals with governments on the basis of nothing. And yet, governments are taking him seriously. After all, the Grand Vizier of the Sultan is meeting with him and thinking as though this is a real possibility. Why? Why is anyone taking him seriously?
Because they think the Jews have a lot of money. They have a lot of,
good. Good. Money. Good. So anti-Semitism, or rather Jewish stereotypes, which are arguably negative Jewish stereotypes, can be used to the advantage of the Jews when people believe in them. And Herzl is taking full advantage of the deeply held beliefs of others about the power, or even nefarious power, of the Jews. Okay. So, as 1896 rolls into 1897, Herzl wants to have a Congress. He wants to have a Congress of all the Zionists. Where is it going to happen? So, he wants it in Germany. And the reason why he wants it in Germany is because Switzerland is a bad idea. Switzerland has a lot of Russian Jewish expatriates, many of whom are extreme radicals, and the Tsarist government has a lot of spies in Switzerland, and they're looking out for every move. You know, Lenin goes to Switzerland at some point. There are a lot of communist rabble-rousers, all sorts of no-goodniks in the eyes of the Tsar are milling about in Switzerland. So better to do it in Germany. So instead of, first the idea was Zurich, but they said, no, let's go to Munich. So it's going to be in Munich. And then the protest happens. The rabbis of Munich, the rabbis of Germany in general, issue a manifesto saying we don't believe in Zionism, it's terrible, it's very, very bad, we don't want us Congress. The rabbis in Munich and the Jewish community of Munich say, you are not welcome here, you Herzl, and your Congress. So if he's not welcome, okay, we'll go to Basel. We'll go a little south to go to Basel. There's a kosher restaurant there, and there's hotel accommodations for our people. We'll have it there. So it ends up happening in the casino in Basel. Now, this idea of the protest rabbi is something that Herzl spends a few good weeks early in 1897 savagely attacking, saying that the state of Jewry is not good. The Jews of Europe are like on a lifeboat that's cast about at sea, and the rabbis who are holding onto the oars are refusing to pedal back to land, saying everything is okay. That's his criticism of the protest rabbis. In truth, Herzl would have a hard time securing the cooperation of the rabbis in the East or the West. And next week we'll have to explain why. So I want to stop here, but actually I want to read one last paragraph from a book, The Origins of Zionism by David Vital, and explain to you why the Zionist Congress was such a difficult thing to pull off. And next week we'll talk about it at length. Here, it says like this. It was the same sense of fragility of the enterprise and in the same vein of irritation that he listed the obstacles around which he would have to maneuver, the groups he would have to avoid offending, the opponents he would have to take into account. So now these are all the people who have a problem with the Zionist Congress, or who are going to bicker in the Congress over who controls the power. So here are the obstacles to success. One, his employers at the New Free Press. Two, the Orthodox Jews. Three, the modernist Jews. Four, the issue of his own status as an Austrian subject. Five, the Turks. Six, the Russian government. Seven, the Christian churches on account of the holy places. Eight, the Chovei Zion in Russia. Nine, Edmund Rothschild and his supporters. 10, the settlers of Eretz Israel who depend upon Rothschild. And lastly, the petty envy and jealousy of the delegates to the Congress. So, well, he will have plenty of people who come to the Congress, but there are so many elements of the Jewish world that he has to worry about not offending, lest this all fall apart. And it's all on his shoulders. So this is the first national gathering of Jews since Bar Kokhba.
Even that wasn't much.
Okay, so we'll stop here.